This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Michael Pollan writes about food, how it's grown, prepared, and consumed, and what that says about our culture. He's published numerous books on the subject. The latest is Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Pollan is also the John S. and James L. Knight Professor of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. He will speak Thursday at Western Michigan University's Miller Auditorium as part of the Center for Humanities Healing Arts series. Michael Pollan, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Gordon. Good to be here.
You are coming to Kalamazoo to hold what we're being told is a community conversation about food. But anyone who's read you or listened to you talk knows that when you start talking about food, it's going to branch off into some other areas. Can you kind of give us the idea of the other areas of life that food affects and how it gets there?
Yeah, well, you're right. Food is attached to so many different things. It's one of those areas in life. You know, there's a great quote by John Muir, the American 19th century American nature writer, and he said that you could pull on one thread in nature and the whole world comes with it, because everything's connected. So food connects us to the earth, and it has an enormous influence on the environment, on the climate, on the quality of the water and the soil, obviously, but it also is the biggest factor in our health, and whether we're struggling with chronic diseases or not can usually be attributed to our diet. So it connects to health in the largest sense, the health of the environment and the health of the individual. And then, of course, there are the animals that are implicated in our food system and our social life. So much of social life has to do with eating. Are we eating together at meals, or are we eating in our cars alone? This has a huge bearing on the quality of civil life in a society. So we'll talk about that, too.
So how does public policy at the government level end up influencing what we eat?
Well, massively. I mean, it's a mistake to regard the food system we have as natural or even the product of the free market in any sense. It's very much a product of the rules of the game that are written by the government and written by the various corporations that influence the government. So the Farm Bill, for example, you know, is the rules by which the whole game is played. And it is the reason that so many farmers grow corn and soy and nothing else. They're well subsidized for doing that and well insured for doing that. And it is the reason that so many of our animals are on feedlots now. It has to do with incentives built into the food system by government policy. So government policy is very important, and we cannot expect to change the food system without changing government policy. There's lots that's happening outside of policy, of course, and there is this alternative food system that's being built brick by brick right now, and that's very exciting. But to really reach a lot of people with a different kind of food, something that's, you know, more wholesome and more sustainable, is going to require addressing policy. And that is very hard to change. It's very, very locked in because it serves the interests of a lot of different parties. Unfortunately, it doesn't serve the interests of our health or the health of the environment, both of which are really damaged by the food system we have. Look, we're dealing with four of the top 10 killers in America are chronic diseases linked to diet. It is really what kills, you know, most of us sooner or later is things tied to the way we're eating. And yet the government at the same time is subsidizing the least healthy calories in the supermarket.
And give us a bit of a run through about how that works. Why is it that the things that are the most unhealthy for us are oftentimes the things that are easiest to afford?
Well, yeah, and that's not an accident. I mean, we subsidize, take corn and soy, for example. We heavily subsidize those, and they're grown on, I think corn is on 100 million acres in the Midwest now, and soy takes turn with corn, of course, in the field. That's the classic rotation. So there's somewhat fewer acres of soy, but not many. They're amazing crops in many ways. They're incredibly efficient ways of getting protein, fat, and carbohydrates off of the land. The problem is they're not really food. Most of the corn and soy that we grow has to be processed. And those two commodity crops, as they're called, are the building blocks of processed food. If you think about corn, it is what feeds the animals that become the feedlot meat and becomes the hamburgers and fast food and the chicken. And then if you think about and then the corn also becomes the sweetener in the soda in the form of high fructose corn syrup. And on the soy side, the oil from the soy is the fat that most of the fast food is fried in. So we society heavily subsidizing these building blocks of a fast food diet. And then you look on the other side, think about the healthier foods, the things that, you know, we're always being told we should eat more of, fruits and vegetables. And you see that there's very little public support. There are no subsidies for fruits and vegetable production. There is some in this last farm bill, which is somewhat more progressive than some previous ones. There is money to research fruits and vegetables to help farmers who want to grow them. And there is, for the first time, money to ensure diversified crops. Because for a long time, and this is another example of the incentive, the only way you could get crop insurance is if you grew a single crop. You had to get a policy for every different crop, and that discouraged people from diversifying. Now we have a program to insure diversified farms, which is a very positive thing in the Farm Bill. But in general, most of the subsidy money is going to subsidize precisely the food the government itself is telling us not to eat. So if you compare my plate, you know, this is the recommendations. It says that 50% of a diet should be fruits and vegetables. That's the official dietary recommendation. What percentage of USDA funding goes to support fruit and vegetable production? 1%. So one hand of the government is telling us eat this way, and the other hand of the government is making it very hard to eat that way.
You've expressed skepticism about what's known as nutritional science. Do you think there are good places for people to go and get information about what is good for them, what are the right foods that they should be eating, or is it just simply a matter of...
Yeah, they should ask their grandmother.
Okay. Relative common sense?
They'd be better off asking their grandmother than the government. I mean, you know, in the most general terms, the dietary advice out there is pretty good. I mean, the consensus is eat a mostly plant-based diet, don't eat too much fat. And the government's not allowed to say avoid sugar because of the power of the lobby, but avoid sugar. So we add that to what they say. There is a lot of science that's confusing. So, for example, we were told for many years that we should focus on fat in the diet as the great dietary evil. And we're now learning that, well, maybe sugar is the great dietary evil. So we're undergoing this sea change. And that's, you know, the product of the scientific process. People make conclusions and do studies, and then new science comes along and changes them. The problem is that whenever there's a little bit of science, the food industry often goes off half-cocked and changes everything. And so there was some evidence to make us concerned about saturated fat, and this got translated by the industry into a rush to create no-fat and low-fat foods, which, as it turned out, made us fat. Because when you take the fat out of food, you have to replace it with something. And since you're taking out flavor, it was often replaced with salt or sugar. So when we heeded the advice to cut down on fat, we binged on carbohydrates. And people now realize, as they did not quite then, because the scientific consensus was all about fat, but people now realize that carbs can make you fat, too. And in fact, they may make you fat more reliably than fat does. Fat makes you full, so it kind of checks your consumption, whereas carbohydrates, especially in a liquid form, i.e. soda or fruit juices, doesn't make you full, so you end up eating too many calories. So, you know, I spent 2 years looking at what do we know about nutrition science. And, yeah, you leave it somewhat skeptical, somewhat humbled by the difficulty of doing it, and also realizing, though, that while they're working this out, while they're trying to figure out what we should eat and what we should not eat, we have some pretty good guidance, and that is to eat real food. And so my conclusion after those 2 years of study was simply this: eat food, not too much, mostly plants. You don't have to worry about nutrients, good and bad. Those are categories of information that scientists need, but we don't need it as eaters. If you think people ate, you know, have eaten for hundreds of thousands of years before nutrition science even existed, there are other ways to know what to eat, and culture is an important one. That's why I say asking your grandmother is not a stupid thing to do, that it is the novelties in the food system that get us into trouble. So, for example, when we invented margarine, which was supposedly a much healthier fat than butter, the grandmothers who were attached to butter had their authority undermined, and they were told, no, that was backward and dangerous and was going to raise your risk of heart disease. And so everyone switched to margarine, and it turned out that this wonderful polyunsaturated fats were being hydrogenated to make them solid at room temperature, and that the trans fats that were created in the process were truly lethal. And they do give people heart attacks much more reliably than saturated fat does. So I think distrusting novelty in the food system, let foods prove out for 100 years before you start eating them, is a good piece of advice. But there's plenty of real food out there still. It's in the supermarket. You don't have to go to the farmer's market to get it, and you don't have to buy organic to get it. It's just the real stuff that people have been eating for a long time. And if you stick to that and avoid highly processed foods, you've dramatically diminished your risk of chronic diseases.
Now, you mentioned those seven words that you gave as advice back in 2007 for an essay in the New York Times: eat food, not too much, mostly plants. So this was over 7 years ago. I'm wondering if you have seen any evidence that people have been heeding that advice, at least more people than were heeding it before you wrote it.
Well, I don't have any science to back that up, but anecdotally, people are, often tell me that those words alone proved enormously helpful to them. And people will sometimes come up to me with a photograph of themselves when they weighed 300 pounds and saying, "All I did was start eating real food, and look at me now." And they're very proud, and I'm very pleased to see that. I mean, it's wonderful if something as simple as that can help people. I just don't think we realize how much trouble things like soda get us into, and that it's just not that complicated, that this subject can be simplified, and it's needlessly complicated by industry. But that's because the way you sell people stuff is you make them anxious, and then you offer them a tranquilizer of your product. And that's a lot of what happens in food. The problem is real food, simple food, the stuff that you find in the peripheries of the supermarket, the stuff that, people have been eating for generations. I'm talking about meat and fish and fruits and vegetables and whole grains. They're not that profitable compared to highly processed food. And they don't have big marketing budgets compared to highly processed food. So what gets pushed at us all the time are the more complicated foods. It's hard to make money selling oatmeal to the public, but you can make a lot of money selling an oatmeal-based breakfast cereal or an oatmeal-based cereal bar or energy bar. And every step of processing makes it less healthy and invariably adds more salt and sugar and fat. So you end up taking a healthy grain and turning it into an unhealthy processed food that you can charge a lot more for.
Do you think the issue of food and our health has become politicized, that some people see an attempt to educate or to regulate when it comes to food as some sort of an infringement on freedom the right to make the choices about what they want to eat when they want to eat it?
Well, it's very interesting how people sit very happily for social engineering by corporations and the fact that they're being manipulated by advertising and marketing all the time. And when you walk down the aisles of the grocery and notice where the healthy cereal is and notice where the junk cereal is, the highly sweetened stuff, the healthy stuff is down by your feet and the sweet, colorful cereal is right at your kid's eye level. And so we're being manipulated all the time. But as soon as a popularly elected representative, such as a mayor or a governor, wants to do something about the way we eat, it's this incredible infringement on our liberty, even though it is being done in our own interest. I'm speaking, of course, of Mayor Bloomberg, who tried to merely tweak the food environment by saying, if you want 32 ounces of soda, you have to get two instead of one giant one. I mean, this is kind of nudge marketing, and it's practiced all the time by industry, but we don't want it practiced by our governments. And we've been trained since Reagan to think of the government as an assault on our liberty, but never the corporation. And, I think they're both trying to influence us in various ways. At least the government you can throw out. You can't throw out the corporation. So, I think there is a role for regulation in the food system. I mean, we are very happy to regulate the food system to ensure our safety. And we are very happy that they inspect the meat before they feed it, because there used to be all sorts of contaminants in the meat, and the industry cheated horribly. That was the story of Upton Sinclair in the jungle. It's the story of China today. people are very happy to have the liberty of meat packers infringed so that they can eat meat that's relatively safe, although not that that system works so well. So what about having the government ensure our health as well as the safety of our meat by taxing unhealthy foods? You know, I happen to support the idea of a soda tax. We're debating that in Berkeley, where I live right now, and in San Francisco. This is considered a horrible infringement of liberty. But people thought that about tobacco taxes, too. And what happened with tobacco taxes? Well, we raised them. They're quite high right now because we saw that tobacco was a substance that offered more harm to people and society than it did benefits. And we raised the price of cigarettes, and we lowered the consumption of cigarettes by about 40%. And we changed the cultural norm in the process. It's not acceptable to smoke in many places. Is this an infringement on people's liberty? Well, yes and no. I mean, on their liberty, but of course, what about the liberty of other people in the same space who had to breathe their smoke? So now we're having that conversation about soda. Now, soda is not identical to cigarettes, and I don't think it's as addictive, although it is addictive. And there is not the problem of secondhand smoke, but there is the problem that the whole society pays the costs of diabetes now, type 2 diabetes. The whole society has an interest in reducing rates of type 2 diabetes because now with, you know, a quasi-nationalized healthcare, I mean, the government is on the hook to treat a lot of that diabetes. So we all have an interest in reducing rates of diabetes. And one way to do that, and I can't guarantee you it's going to work, it may not work, but one thing to try is to tax the substance that's most responsible for type 2 diabetes, and that's soda.
There's a lot of talk we hear about science working on different ways to prepare food better. At the end of the day, do these things end up working against us? In other words, it just becomes cheaper and easier to produce food that at the end of the day isn't that good for us, and we'd be better off, as you say, visiting the produce section and picking up some fresh fruits and vegetables rather than what we hear may be the newest way to eat something that we'd like and supposedly isn't going to cause us any health problems.
Yeah, you know, look, I mean, the problem with technological innovation in food is not that it's inherently a bad idea, but it has tended not to work that well for the last several years. I mean, but if you look at the long history of processing food, which we also call cooking, there have been a great many breakthroughs that were of enormous benefit to the public. I'm thinking about learning how to ferment food. You know, that's a technology, too, and that was a huge innovation, even though it was really old. Or how to leaven bread, how to bake bread with yeast and sourdough cultures. This made wheat much healthier than it used to be and much more delicious and much more convenient. And so we have done this well before, innovated food in a way that made it better for us and more delicious. Have we done it recently? I mean, you know, coming up with examples of food processing technologies, certainly freezing and canning are very important, and frozen vegetables in particular are a really good option. And sometimes they're more nutritious than fresh vegetables, which people don't realize, because if they're, you know, frozen at the peak of ripeness, they're going to have more nutrients than they are if they're shipped across the country. What else? Freeze drying, I don't think it's really made food any better. I guess it's useful if you go camping. But a lot of the so-called innovations in recent years have tended to make food more entertaining, more convenient, but haven't really helped us. I have a completely open mind, though, that maybe there are technological solutions to improve food. But I don't think it's the big challenge. You know, you have a lot of people in Silicon Valley are out now to disrupt the food system, and they have ideas of simulating real food. You know, there's this product called Soylent, which is a powder that supposedly has all the nutrients you need so you don't have to waste time eating. Well, I like eating. I mean, eating is about pleasure also and community and my social life. It's not just about getting all the chemicals I need. And by the way, do we know enough to give you all the chemicals you need? The history of baby formula suggests that we don't, that we've gotten that wrong for 140 years. We've yet to make infant formula that is as good for babies as mother's milk. So we need to be humble about our ability to reinvent the food supply. We just don't know enough. Foods are kind of brilliant products of coevolution. I mean, they have evolved to give us what we need. And that's a long, complicated process, and it's arrogant to think we can replace that with technology. But maybe I'll be proved wrong. I wouldn't mind if I were.
Michael Pollan, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Michael Pollan is an author and educator who will speak Thursday at Western Michigan University's Miller Auditorium as part of the Center for Humanities Healing Arts series. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.